With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to worship at the altar of music and comedy. The giddiness and the harmony of a well-crafted comedy song brings great joy in abundance. Join the tinkling talents of David Thames and me, Phil Nickel. Sit back, turn it up, and enjoy Songs in the Key of Laugh.
Hey, gang, welcome back to our podcast, Songs in the Key of Laugh. I'm Phil Nickel.
I'm David Timms.
And we got a great episode. This is episode, well, I'm not sure what.
I think we're episode nine?
What?
Ten? Nine?
This nine?
One of them.
Nine. And we have an amazing episode. No, this episode, we decided to discuss Americana. It's like American comedy songs. From the earliest days of American comedy songs through to what's the most relevant. So that's what we're going to be discussing.
And being Canadian, you know everything there is to know about Americana, no, don't you?
Exactly. I am Mr. Americana. But yeah. Americana includes Canada.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
fair
there's
enough.
Been great, some great Canadian comedy songs. Well, I've written a few of them. That sounds horrible me saying I wrote great Canadian comedy songs.
I didn't want to say it.
On this show, we've got this comedy song contest, right?
Yes, it's a competition.
It's a contest.
It's a competition.
We've got a great song this week. About a horse, which fits into our Americana.
Like cowboys?
Yeah.
We've also got a phenomenal guest.
Oh, we do.
We do. This week, we have been so lucky to get Rich Hall on the show.
Here.
Yeah.
Rich performs as a character, Otis Lee Crenshaw. Who is a
recidivist convict from Tennessee, arrested on charges of trumped up charges of possession of endangered coral, married six times, all the women named Brenda.
Yeah, got a Brenda tattoo. I remember that. It's, it's big. Yeah. It's like right down one arm.
Yeah.
Now, so I remember when you invented that character because you played.
So the American comedy songbook is vast. It's huge. I mean, all from going back. I mean, further than Louis Jordan. Do you know much about Louis Jordan?
I don't know much about Louis
he's like
Jordan.
He's like a sort of an early jazzer. He goes like, "Dadgum your hat, boy. Dadgum your dirty hat. Dadgum your dirty dog. I gave you the pig and you wanted a hog." He did like, there ain't nobody here but those chickens. I mean, it's just funny. He did, and he's like, you know, "Open the door, Richard, open the door and let me in." It's about a guy who's drunk. "I'm drunk again." But it was comical. But the music's amazing. Like the music is phenomenal. I learned that about Louis Jordan through Joe Jackson, the British singer who did a whole album called Jump and Jive. I think it was called. That is something to check out if you're into musical comedy songs. Check out a little bit of Louis Jordan. But from those early days through to, I don't know, like stuff like Sarah Silverman. You know. You know, was it Jesus is Magic? I think. But she's. You know, pretty hardcore songs are pretty hardcore. I think there's one called AIDS Ballad, which I don't know if that would be something you would necessarily get away with anymore. But
I don't think you would, no.
And then there's Steve Martin, who, known as a comedian, he's that song, "I'm a Ramblin'." He played the banjo, "I'm a Ramblin' Man, I'm a Ramblin', I'm Ramblin', I'm a Ramblin' Guy." Have you seen Ramblin' Guy?
I have seen it, yes. Yeah. I've seen it on YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, but he's so amazing. He's actually now, and he's ended up winning a Grammy Award for playing the banjo.
He's a phenomenal banjo player, isn't he?
So, yeah. Banjos, sort of lend themselves to comedy, I think, somehow.
I think they do. I think it's that ridiculous, the sound. It's very, you've got to be quite talented to play banjo. Finger picking's not easy.
Yeah.
Do you play the banjo, Phil?
I've got a banjo. I can't say I play it. No,
yeah, you've got a theremin.
I've not learned the role on the banjo quite yet. Ross Noble plays the banjo.
Does he?
Yeah. Maybe we get him on the show and talk about it. I don't know if he considers himself a musical comedian, but he was in a musical. He was in Young Frankenstein.
I think we should definitely get him on then.
Yeah. Okay. We've got to get him on. If you're listening, Ross, please come on our podcast.
Thanks, Ross. So I've been looking around, Phil, because we were doing Americana. I thought I'm going to have a look at some really cool country ballads.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
There's a lot of funny, I mean, knowingly funny country comedy songs.
There is. But I do like the way that in a lot of country music, they have like a kind of tongue-in-cheek thing going on. Like in Stand By Your Man, for example.
Right.
Sometimes it's hard to be a woman giving all your love to just one man. I think it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek just in general, that whole song, but it's a really beautiful number. Yeah. But then you also have the other extreme of the spectrum where you have songs like, there was one called My Dog, which is about somebody wishing that their dog was their wife rather than...
I don't know if that's acceptable.
It's absolutely not acceptable. There's also.
There's John Denver one. Please, Daddy, don't get drunk this Christmas.
Oh my God!
Please, Daddy, don't get drunk this Christmas. I don't want to see my mama cry.
Oh my God, that's so depressing.
That was really funny.
There was a song, Having a Beer with Jesus.
Having a Beer with Jesus, yeah.
Yeah, that was quite...
There's not a country song, but there's a song called Jogging for Jesus. If you guys Google Jogging for Jesus, and it's great. It's one of my favorite comedy songs.
Jogging for Jesus.
Yeah, I don't think they think it's a comedy song. I think it's a serious song, but Jogging for Jesus.
Okay. Well, I found one that I really that I thought I'd share.
Okay.
It's a bit of a like a country bluesy style one. It goes like this. You're the reason I'm round and round on recap tires. You're the reason I'm hanging all our clothes on wires. You're the reason our kids are ugly, little darling. But looks ain't everything, and money ain't everything. But I love you just the same. You're the reason our kids are ugly.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, it's strong.
It's a comedy song, but it's not really, it's comical. It's heartfelt. It's a love song.
It is. I mean, it goes on later on. I guess we won't ever have everything we need. Because when we get ahead, it's just another mouth to feed.
Right.
And then it says, and that's the reason that my good looks and figure have gone. It is quite heartfelt.
It's very, a very Randy Newman-esque sound, that. Who wrote that song?
I think it was written by Conway Twitty.
Oh, Conway Twitty. Oh, gosh, I love Conway Twitty. I mean, the other great Americana writers are people like John Prine, Doc Watson, John Prine.
Yeah.
And John Prine. But John Prine wrote serious music. I mean, the man's amazing. It was amazing.
Well, you just mentioned Randy Newman as well.
Yeah, Randy Newman.
Randy Newman, he's won many a like award.
Yeah, he's won Oscars.
Yeah, he has.
But he's the guy that wrote Short People. I don't remember that. Go up, Short People. I can't know. Go
short. Short people ain't got no. Hold on one sec. I think it's. Short people got no reason. Short people ain't got no reason. Short people ain't got no reason to live.
That's a great tune.
They got little hands and little eyes, walk around telling great big lies. They got little noses and tiny little teeth. They wear little platform shoes on their nasty little feet. Well, I don't want no short people around here.
That's great. I mean, that's just so funny. So I was listening to this series called The Bottom Line. I think it's called The Bottom Line Archive Series. And it's but basically it's a songwriter's recordings, and they do it live at The Bottom Line. And they have people like Billy Bragg and Suzanne Vega, you know, John Cale. I mean, they've had all these, Rick Ocasek, all these amazing songwriters. They sing one of their own songs live in front of an audience, and then they choose a song, their favorite song, and they sing at. And it's really worth listening to The Bottom Line if you can find it anywhere. Well, you find it online, The Bottom Line. But one of the songs I heard on it was, years ago, was a John Prine song, and it just made me howl. So I'm going to play it for it. I packed my bags and bought myself a ticket for the land of the tall palm tree. Aloha, old Milwaukee. Hello, Waikiki. Just stepped down from the airplane when I heard her say, waka waka nuka luka waka naka luka luka, would you like a lay? Let's talk dirty in Hawaiian, whisper in my ear. Kikapuka meka waka hini are the words I long to hear. Lay your coconut on my tiki. What the heck, a mooka mooka dear? Let's talk dirty in Hawaiian are the words I long to hear. That's Fred Kohler and John Prine. So there's a lot of like smut in Americana songs, like Americana comedy songs. I mean, I think like we've always said on the podcast that scatological humor is a big part of making people laugh, isn't it?
Of course it is. Yeah, I do think that there's a lot of old songs that are very misogynistic, and I think that it's quite important to stay away from that nowadays. Well, but
well, yeah, I guess it's just they were signs of the times. Now I wanted to talk about Frank Zappa, because although we could do an entire episode on Frank Zappa, because he's not purely a comedy songwriter, but he wrote some great comedy songs like Don't Eat Yellow Snow or Catholic Girls. Or...
Did he invent Don't Eat Yellow Snow as a thing?
I don't think so. I think that's I've always known that as a Canadian idea, but maybe he did.
Everything's Canadian, isn't it? Canadian. Yeah. Chips, Canadian. Pizza, Canadian. Honestly.
You say chips, you mean crisps.
And they're Canadian, are they?
Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa stood up for anti-censorship. I mean, it was a huge part of his career. And it's odd coming from, you know, just being a musician, but just standing up for, you know, he didn't take drugs himself, but he was against the war on drugs, and he stood up for being able to say and do anything. And I think that's why I admired Frank Zappa. But he had a song called Catholic Girls, and it's kind of rude and funny, but it kind of sums up Catholic girls and from his perspective. But in the song Catholic Girls, he goes, Catholic girls, and the little girls go, Warren Cuccarello. They say this name of a guy, Warren Cuccarello. Do you know who Warren Cuccarello is?
Who's that?
Well, Warren Cuccarello was one of the mothers of invention. It was in Frank Zappa's band, Warren Cuccarello. But he also was in a band called Missing Persons that I was a big fan of when I was a teenager. And he was in Duran Duran later on in life. And I was on the Ned Sheeran show. I was on Loose Ends on a Saturday morning with Ned Sheeran. And it was like a round table, like a live, it's still on the radio now, but Ned Sheeran sadly has passed away. And it had, Sir Peter Hall was on, and I can't remember the name of a huge filmmaker.
You're right there,
huge,
Phil.
Huge filmmaker, yeah. And it had Michael Adonigi was there, and it, just the whole table. And then it had Simon Le Bon was on, and I was the comedy act. And I was like all the way around the other end, because they as the guests go around, they become less and less well known. And I was going to be singing a song. And then sitting behind Simon Le Bon, like on another side of the room, was this bald guy just with a guitar. And Simon Le Bon was going to play a song with this bald guy. And so when it got Simon Le Bon, after all these really famous people, Simon Le Bon goes, Ned Sheeran, who's this behind you? And he goes, oh, that's my guitar player, Warren Cuccarello. And I, forgetting I was on live radio, went, oh my God, you're Warren Cuccarello? You are Warren, this is Warren, you're Warren Cuccarello? Oh my God, this is, and everyone's looking at me like, Ned Sheeran's going, like, don't, and I was going, it's Warren Cuccarello from The Mother's Invention. Like, this is, oh, this, oh my God, you're, I can't wait to tell my friends I've met Warren Cuccarello. Warren Cuccarello. And I'm going on, and he's just smiling, and I'm going, you're the, maybe the most famous person I've ever met. And I'm sitting at a table full of famous people. Yeah, I've met Warren Cuccarello. All the Catholic boys. Warren Cuccarello. Catholic boys. Kinda young, kinda wild. Catholic boys. Vinny Colaiuta.
So, Phil, we've had more submissions again for our comedy song competition.
The contest.
That's it, the competition.
The comedy song contest. The Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song contest.
It's a competition
which you can enter if you're a budding, well, you don't have to be a budding comedy songwriter, but it's a contest with the prize money. There's prize money. I guarantee you big money. Send your songs.
You're guaranteeing
in.
Big money, are you, Phil?
Big money. send your songs, comedy songs, into songsinthekeyoflaugh@gmail.com.
And this week, the submission, it is about a horse. Yeah, it's called Horse Friend, and it is by Mark Johnson.
Nature has a deep connection that we humans have lost long ago. There exists an ancient wisdom that only the animals know. A horse frolics in the pasture, the morning still sparkles with dew. Would you join me if I asked you to dine at my table for two? I sneak up behind you and I tickle your ears. You love when I show that I care. And then I tell you a story while you munch on my hand about this wonderful world that we share. Why do you tease me? Just tell me the things that you know. But you must take it easy, for this is only my first rodeo. His manners so distinguished, a wisdom so deep and profound. My struggle, it has finished. My tears fall like rain to the ground. You can sneak up behind me, you must tickle my ears. I need you to show that you care. And you can tell me a story while I munch from your hoof about this wonderful world that we share. Oh, you sneak up behind me, yes, you tickle my ears. I love when you show that you care. And you can tell me your stories while I munch from your hoof about this wonderful world that we share.
Given a song we know and have to change it up and make it so hysterical that you win the cup. This game is really easy, just follow all the rules. The rules are really simple, you're not allowed to lose.
It's the quickfire parody game, and if you've been listening to the podcast for all, you know this might be one of the trickier bits of the podcast to actually get through.
But we're speak we're for yourself, Phil. Honestly,
we're sticking with it until this season's over. The quickfire parody game, if you don't know, is I give David a challenge, David, to come up with a quickfire parody for an. I give him an artist name, and I give him the name of a song, and then he comes up with a quickfire parody, and then he does the same to me. So, David, this week I thought I would be really tricky and give you TLC, No Scrubs.
that is a throwback.
What do you got? Do you know it? Yeah. So this is the quickfire parody game, and David's going to do TLC's No Scrubs. What do you got?
Okay.
No thinking.
I don't want no bugs, because bugs are annoying and they just keep biting me. And I don't want to buy spray, because spray is expensive, and that is...
I saw it on TV.
And I saw it on TV.
You could have just gone no shrubs. like a with a gardening theme.
I don't want no shrubs.
Quick fire parody game.
Okay, Phil, your turn now. I would like you to parody the Prince song, When Doves Cry.
Oh.
So you're going to parody it as quickly as you possibly can, it being a quick fire round, When Doves Cry.
I'm not gonna leave you standing. I'm gonna knock you out cold. Maybe you think I'm demanding. I think you're like your father, too slow. Maybe you're just like your mother. She didn't have a right hook. Why do we scream at each other? Because this is what it sounds like when my gloves fly.
When my gloves fly?
It's a boxing. It's got in a boxing.
I would have gone with this is what it feels like when dogs die. Or something, when your family dog dies.
No.
Do you write comedy songs?
Ever dream of being the next Tim Minchin?
Or being Tim Minchin?
That's weird.
Yeah.
Why not enter our Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song competition and maybe appear on our podcast?
With Tim Minchin.
That's better.
The Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song competition. Enter today. Visit songsinthekeyoflaugh.com for details.
Okay, so Phil, we did have an amazing time last week. A couple of weeks ago.
It was very interesting. Yeah, we went to the Chuckle Hut.
The Chuckle Hutch. Yes.
Did our first live
in-person interview
for this series of this podcast.
And it was it was really, really touching, actually.
Yep, we met his little dog.
We
Sarge.
Did meet his dog, and I had a jam with him as well, which was so, so cool.
Yeah.
So
we're excited to present this interview with the wonderful Mr. Rich Hall.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Guest on today's show is someone you might know. And if you don't, that's your own fault. But you'll know them soon.
You boy, you will.
This jingle has been personalized for a guest that we hope that you recognize. And this week their name is...
Insert name here.
Rich Hall, it's Rich Hall, everybody.
Hi, Rich.
Now, you guys probably, if you don't know Rich Hall before, there's so much I could tell you about the guy. Well, he's appeared on. It's really. Can I just say, this is the first time we're doing this live.
It's very weird. So doing normally it in a room.
Normally we introduce you by going, it's Rich Hall. He's been on. He wrote for David Letterman. He's on Saturday Night Live. He's got, you know, he's just done that kind of comedian. And then I go, hi, Rich. And you go, hi. But now you're right here. It seems weird giving you credits to your face.
That's all right. Just in case your listeners don't know, now they do.
The thing is, it's not one of those things like, you know, in American comedy clubs where they go, this next act, you've seen him on this episode. Yeah. It's not. It's just to put people in the frame of what they're about to hear.
Yeah.
Rich performs as a character, Otis Lee Crenshaw, who is a...
Recidivist convict from Tennessee,
yeah.
arrested on charges of trumped up charges of possession of endangered coral. Married six times. Oh, the women named Brenda.
Yeah, got a Brenda tattoo. I remember that. It's big. Yeah. It's like right down one arm.
Yeah.
No. So I remember when you invented that character because you played actually with the Gadflies, who Mick Moriarty and Phil Moriarty, who are friends of mine, who I've also played with. Mick and Phil have played in one of my shows as well. And they were your backing band. Was having them be convicts, did that have anything to do with the idea?
No, I just, I worked with them a couple of times in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And they were over for Edinburgh, and they were doing other shows, but they said, yeah, let's do this thing upstairs in the Gilded Balloon. And I just had this idea. I had about three songs and an idea for a character. So we figured we'd pad out the show with guests.
Yeah.
So we got some,
I was on. I did it every day with Boothby Graffo.
Yeah.
If you remember. Well, we didn't do it every day. We did it the days where you needed a guest because sometimes by the end of it, it was becoming quite exciting and you were getting, you had some pretty big guests.
Yeah.
Who's the guy that does come up and see me sometime? Steve Harley.
Steve Harley, he was not happy with the sound. He kept complaining about the sound. I thought, come on, it's like midnight at the Gilded Balloon. What do you want?
I know. In an upstairs, like what used to be like an office or a toilet.
And I think George was our sound guy even back then. And he didn't put up with that. George is this pure Scotsman, Gandalf-looking guy. Do you know George?
Yeah, I know George. Yeah,
and he's a great sound guy, but he's going to do what he does, and he... You know,
yeah. It doesn't matter. It's Steve with Steve Harley.
Yeah, but I was thrilled to have Steve Harley on.
Yeah, I remember? Well, we actually because we weren't on that show. Boothby Graffo and I did a prison cellmates called the Bucket Brothers.
Yeah,
and we just made stuff up, and it was pretty silly, David. And Boothby Graffo was also a brilliant musical comedian.
Yeah.
And that was the first time we worked with Otis Lee Crenshaw, and then it went on, but then it became something like that run. Remember, it became more and more successful.
Next year became successful, and then...
What year was that, the first year?
I think the first year was about 98.
Right.
And then we did it in 99, and then in 2000, and then...
And that's the year that you won the Perry Award.
He won the Perry
Award. He won the Perry Award. Yeah. You had to differentiate.
Yeah, I had nothing to do.
Rich Hall has never won the Perry Award, ladies and gentlemen.
No.
So you said that you had, like, three songs that this kind of character was built around. Did you write these songs with the character in mind, or was the character the one that had written these songs?
I wrote them with the character in mind, and the character is just an amalgam of all my relatives in North Carolina and Tennessee and Kentucky who would show up once a year at Christmas and just be awful. Pure white trash, day release type people. There's a lot of them in my family, and... it was always easy for me to understand that character, you know.
Yeah.
It's real easy to be. I'm not great at impersonations or anything, but I can definitely do a Southern voice. It's just...
Yeah, it was lovely, though, because it was such a definite character for you, as like, knowing you as Rich Hall and knowing what you do as a comedian as Rich Hall, though, Otis Lee Crenshaw was very, very much this character piece, exaggerated, a bit mad.
And the best thing about it was that I was not a good piano player. I think only started playing piano maybe a couple years before, but it was built on a guy who doesn't understand why his songs are never being recorded. They're about prison rape and bad lady sex.
Was the one? There was one I remember about the toilet seat, the shining of the toilet
seat.
Yeah,
he almost looks like you.
He almost looks like you.
And
but that was one of the original three.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
I remember,
And I think by the end of the run, we probably had six or seven songs because they just, you know, in that initial, when you're initially building a new character like that or something, it just floods you all the ideas. Eventually, of course, you run out. And I haven't actually done Otis in probably 8 years now.
Okay.
And I kind of wonder if, I don't even know if, how he would come across now, because he really was kind of, I think there would just be too much backlash now.
I have to say, though, over the last few weeks, knowing that we were going to interview you, I've watched quite a lot. And when we do interviews with people, I end up sitting and listening to like full back catalogues of things, and a lot of the stuff I can say is dated and is done in a way that I don't think would necessarily be okay right now.
Yeah.
But I didn't get that feeling. I didn't get that feeling with that character.
Yeah.
I didn't. I thought because you do it in a way that, I think it seems like so much of it is improvised,
yeah,
as well. But actually, having played with you, I know that a lot of it is improvised.
Yeah.
The way that you do it, I feel like you. It's not getting away with it, but I feel like you.
Well, I would say that you've got a verbal dexterity, yeah, in the songs that shows a cleverness underneath the.
Yeah,
it's not it's not just going for cheap punches.
Yeah,
never. Yeah. I mean, when you look back, I mean,
yeah,
probably some of it would be considered lowbrow now. But of course, when you're in a character, as you know, your character has a point of view of the world, and if his point of view is that he's just not caught up with, say, the modern woke,
sure,
culture or anything. So
sure,
it's hard. I think a lot of people would just go, wow, this guy's... I think I could get away with a lot more stuff than I could.
You probably could take that character if he came back and make him, like, pro-Trump, sort of make him almost the voice of that, which allows him to say things.
Yeah.
You know, because... I mean, I don't know. I never try to be too political with my comedy, and I don't think you are necessarily. You've done political rants, but you're not a political comedian in my mind.
Not at all. No,
you're a surrealist. And,
yeah.
When you're writing these songs, so you're writing songs for Rich Hall now.
Yeah, I think another thing is I feel like I just like Otis ran its course. Like, how much more can you just sing about depravity and, you know, breaking and entering in prison? And to be honest, I really did want to improvise more. I wanted to, like, be able to write songs that were kind of had a template that the band has to learn, but that you can push certain, like, personal information from someone in the audience and wedge it into the song.
Mm. Yeah.
The band has to know what to play, obviously, but I can, like, change the words around. So there's a lot of that in what I do now. And to be honest, I'm enjoying it more than Otis because I hated dragging that piano around.
Right.
I refused to play something that wasn't weighted keys. So everywhere I went, I had to drag this thing, which I now have beside me. And I just thought, man, this is, you know. Otis isn't famous enough to have, he's not going to get famous enough to have a roadie and a crew. So this is just never going to end.
So now you're doing more improv stuff. Like when you play to the Cray Cray Cabaret, which was with the show that Dave and I run at the Comedy Store every second Wednesday. Come and see it. But you did a section on it, though, that was one, I'm not even sure what was happening, but you were just completely riffing off something that happened in the audience.
Yeah.
But you turned it into a song. It became it became magical because it was like the band were just, I could see David working to keep the band
in
tow. And then you even commented going, you don't even know what they're playing. Like, I'm not sure you were even playing the same thing. It just sounded amazing. Is that just a set piece that you do of improv, or do you try to do that for the whole show?
No, there are set pieces. Like, this show is called The Hoedown, and we've been touring it for about 5 years now.
Right.
The first half is what you would is the old guy coming out ranting about the state of the world.
Okay.
And that's good for 45 minutes or 50. But, you know, nobody wants to see an old guy on stage for 2 hours. Just get over it, Grandpa. So the second half, and the first half is very much taking down America. I think it's very critical of America and Britain. The second half then sort of comes back and celebrates Americana, you know, the whole country music ethos. But we try to... my initial point of view is, why is country music just about, you know, the hardworking blue collar Americans? Why can't it be about you people? Mm. You know, you're a, you know, graphic illustrator, or you work over the civil service. Come on, why didn't they get their songs? So quite often there's a built-in kind of joke about making a heroic song about a job that is clearly not heroic, you know.
Right.
And that's just very funny to me because, you know, so many country songs are about miners, truckers.
Yeah.
Mm. And sometimes we get those guys, and we do have those kind of songs that address what people do. I've got a lot of occupation songs now because I just found when I was talking to the crowd, you're going to get a lot of nurses and you're going to get a lot of teachers. And you're going to get
IT.
IT. Yeah. So I think I've been through three different IT iterations, so to speak. And when you have those and someone says, I do that, then suddenly it's like, wow, we got something from, you know, gardeners. So we have a huge catalog of rehearsed stuff that we know that just in that moment goes, oh, you're a gardener? Here's a song about guys who have died in lawn and garden accidents. Which we, you know, is true.
And do they start off those things? They all start off improvised. So, so if somebody does say, I'm an axe murderer, then it's you just go from I'm an axe, you just go into it and.
No. Not really. Like, I think one of my inspirations when I think about it is it was Corky and the Juice Pigs. Because Sean was astounding. I mean,
and
his guitarist.
I'm the guitarist.
Oh, you mean when he was solo. Oh,
but that, I mean, when I used to watch that, and he would, as far as I could tell, like completely off the cuff. And I don't know how Dylan stayed up. I don't know if Dylan was pushing it or if he, who, it was hard to say who was pushing the song.
Yeah.
Like there was a melody there, you know, there was a structured song.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of times they got the same thing again. But,
That is part of it, though, is you do end up hearing the same things again. So, But Sean, you know, he had used similar words, but he hated repeating himself and hated repeating melodies and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think in a way I thought, God, that just looks amazing. Mm. And I, when you have a four-piece band, you've got to teach them. You got to teach them, here's the frame of the song. Mm. Learn this, and I will put in the words, or else it would just be all over the place.
Yeah.
You know? Unless you're doing jazz, you know?
Yeah.
I guess.
You play with a guy called Rob Childs.
Yeah,
he's like a lap steel guitarist.
Yeah,
who's played on one of my albums.
Yeah, he did your Phantom 309.
A Warning of Greasy Fist Joe.
Yes, Greasy Fist Joe.
He's in the video. Yeah. He also did Hemophiliac Albino Cowboys, which was on last.
That was on a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, last episode. Yeah. And what's it like playing? So you have a regular band that you've been playing with for
years. Yeah, and they're pretty tight, you know. And so we constantly trying to come up with new stuff, and I'm constantly trying to think of songs that that apply to the responses from the audience. You know, not always about occupations, about how people met. I've probably written about 70 verses of a song about what kind of car a guy was driving when he met his wife. And this could go back to like 50 years ago.
Wow.
So you're talking about, you know, Morris's and Miners and sometimes, you know. And as soon as I get a new car, I have to go home and think, all right, what are the possible rhymes?
What are the rhymes?
And just trying to keep it all in my head, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, and you're banking on the fact that it's going to be a shitty car.
Yeah.
But sometimes you get goes, I had a Porsche.
Yeah. You know,
well, this is not going to work. So then I had to go back and rewrite and start thinking about, well, what if he had a good car, like a Porsche or a BMW or something? Mm. And then you got to change the format a bit. Mm. And then you get guys who say, well, you didn't have a car. So then I had to write a song about a guy who just had shoes. So there are like two or three backups now for possible scenarios.
Yeah.
So what I like is the challenge of constantly being able to just address something with the least amount of information, you know. Hey, what kind of car are you driving? Or, you know, where did you meet? Or
Right. So it's wide open.
Yeah. And also, because we go out on the road a lot, trying to write songs that are very local.
Right.
Which involves learning a lot of names of nearby towns.
Yes.
The river that runs through the town.
But you write that when you get there at the town? Or
yeah,
you,
but
or
the
you
song know- is written. Like, almost every town we play, there is a really crappy river running through it.
Right, yeah.
And so we have a song that's about the name of that river. And it ends up being about all the rivers in Britain and what weird names they have. Because they're not like the Cahoolawassee or the, you know, the Mississippi or anything. They're like the Itchen.
Yeah, or the Tay.
The Ooze, the Tay.
The Tay.
Yeah.
You've got so the this, Isis as well going through.
Yeah. There's a where, there's a when, there's a way, a when, a where, and a why.
A why.
River.
Yeah.
So
there's a song right there.
Yeah, so yeah. That's pretty much the last line. You're telling me there's a where, there's a when, and there's a where, a when, and a why?
Well,
no way.
Where's the when?
No way. It runs through Surrey. So,
but you wrote a so you. I remember one of the first things I saw you do, and I it might have been Otis. It must have been Otis Lee who did it. But you took like a map of Scotland. It was like, and you were just based because there's so many crazy named towns in Scotland. Yeah. And you was it improvised or was it or was
no,
it written?
No, not at all.
But it was
no.
It was basically like a I've been everywhere man type song where you just named.
That's kind of was the inspiration for it. But rather than do a really fast song like that, which is just. I mean, that's a very fast song.
Yes.
And it'd be impossible to remember all that.
I know. I saw you do play with Beer Gut 100, Bill Bailey's punk band, and you did The End of the It's the End of the World as We Know It.
Yeah.
And you nailed it.
Yeah.
You did every word of that song. So you could do it.
Yeah. But we slowed it down because I think also the Scared Weird Little Guys used to do I've Been Everywhere based on Australia.
Towns. Yeah.
And so I didn't want to. Just do that. So I just kind of took the towns that kind of almost sounded like part of a word, you know. It was a Scottish cheating song.
Right.
It was, baby, I've been reading your phone bill, and I got to, who the hell is Clyde Bank, you know.
Right.
And, yeah. We had a song about the underground, and then we had one about Ireland, which ended up being about a woman who's eaten too much. Porter down that tub of curry. Because what I'm saying is, you ain't trim.
I couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, I know.
It's really funny. It's still funny, though. You know what? It's not. You can do it, but it's,
You can, but, you know, I don't really buy into the... I mean, you know, there's a juggernaut of change going on now, and I always figured they were going to come after comedians, and we've always gotten away with... stuff that nobody else can get away with.
Yes.
And now it's just got to be, now you just got to be a little bit more careful about what you can get away with.
Well, yeah.
And you also got to be aware that in the room, most of those people are buying it. They're, you know, they're with you.
Yeah.
It's when it gets into the other world, you know, taken out of context and people, whoa, blah, 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 why is he making fun of so-and-so? It's just. Yeah.
We're from a generation. Well, I mean, you predate me slightly, but you were from a generation where almost like you know where the, we knew where the line was, and stepping over it was part of the fun. And then that was that. So for the people in the room, you're like, oh, step over the line. But now it feels like you've got to know where the line is, and you go to it, and then you stick there. And it doesn't seem to be as free or as fun. But maybe that is a necessity. I don't know.
If you feel the slightest tinge of guilt. about it.
Sure.
You know, you should probably...
Sure.
I mean, try it out, but, you know...
Sure.
Don't, you know, you got to be... It depends on, you know, how big an audience. There's things you can do in a club you can't do on TV, you know.
Yeah.
Because someone on TV is going to get upset.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to... I don't know. I don't really even read, go on Twitter or anything. Mm. So... Personally, it wouldn't bother me.
Right.
I mean, people come and go, hey, man, you screwed up. You're all over Twitter. I go, I don't care. But if it started canceling gigs, all right, you know, this is...
But that is...
That's part of it. There's always been a challenge. There's always been a challenge to, like, stay ahead of the game, you know? Mm. That's what you have to do as a comedian.
So I'd really like to ask you about your comedy influences. So you said that you liked the Juice Pigs beforehand.
Yeah.
Is there anybody else that, you know, at the beginning of your career or even when you were growing up that you listened to and you thought, that's something funny, that's something I want to do?
Yeah. I mean, basically, my dad had a great sense of humor. He was a pretty rough guy, you know, and pretty much of a redneck, but he just loved most of the comedy on TV. Even when I would come in to, you know, the living room and he'd be watching Monty Python and the Two Ronnies and Reginald Perrin. Mm. Like, they got those shows on PBS in America. And that just, and he loved that stuff. Mm. You know, he was just laughing like crazy at Monty Python. This is a guy who was like, was a welder. He's been in a ditch all day. And I'm sure, you know. He went to work the next day and told his buddies, I was watching this British Monty Python. What's wrong with Archie Bunker? But he watched that, too.
Yeah.
And so I watched all those comedy shows growing up, and never really, when I look back now, I think some of these guys were not as funny as others. But there were very few comedians that I didn't want to watch, you know. Even Red Skelton and people like that, who now I go, oof, oof. But it was just all funny. And my dad kind of endorsed it by merely having it on TV. So I also happened to have no idea what I was going to do. I was working on a newspaper in Tennessee and writing slot notices, which are obituaries. I had a journalism degree,
right?
And I got this job, and I thought, this is my career. I'm going to be a journalist. I'm going to write stories. And I ended up in Knoxville, Tennessee, just basically at night putting together information about dead people, like a magpie of death. And just, you know...
Which is crazy thing is pre-internet, just, you know, couldn't just Google stuff.
Everybody on the paper would come in and throw matchbook covers and napkins and envelopes with bits of information about someone dead that they'd picked up.
Right.
So I had to put all that together.
Whoa.
And then send these people off into the afterlife who I'd never met and at night. And it was only me. It was only me and a couple of copy editors and then everybody in the composing room, which was upstairs, which was like... unbelievably loud, like a war, like these huge linotype machines. And half the people who worked there were deaf before they were hired. They actually hired deaf people. There were a lot of deaf people who worked the composing machines back then because they were so loud. And it was just horrible. And I thought, I can't do this.
How old were you then?
22. Yeah.
And so, when did you start doing comedy?
I quit. I saw a preacher... at the University of Tennessee with a loud hailer, and he looked like Robert Mitchum. He had white linen suit, and he had a loud hailer, and he would just get students together and go, all you women, I don't know why there's so many whorehouses in this town when you co-eds are giving it away for free. And he would get this crowd, and the crowd would be vicious.
Wow.
But there was nothing they could say to this guy that he hadn't heard before. And I went outside to watch him. And, like, there was a great moment where he said, he was just quoting the Bible, and he says, so-and-so, as it says in Jeremiah, and somebody sure enough went, bullfrog, and he went, thank you. And he knew every, like, you've never seen anyone who's just so used to being heckled that they had a response for everything.
Wow.
And I just thought he was astounding. I mean, he was obviously, you know, and this is 18 and 19-year-olds, and some of them are, like, kind of listening to him, and that's disturbing. But I went up and talked to him, and he was just like, so I do 250 colleges a year. He's still going. His name is Jed Smock. All he does is college campuses.
Wow.
And I went back upstairs, and I just thought, wouldn't it be funny if he'd gotten all these, you got all these people together, and then after about 5 minutes, just as they're about ready to, you know, hate you, you just pull the rug out from under them, and it turns out you're just being an evangelist.
Yeah.
And you're making fun of him. And every college knew this guy. So I just said, I'm going to be a street performer. I'm going to baptize dogs. And that's what I did. I baptized dogs. I got a suit and I got a picture of the dogs playing poker and dog treats. And sure enough, hey, there's always a dog.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, a dog would come up. Sure. And I'd just get him to come up and I'd basically just, you know, improvise a lot, and then pour the water over them and say, reject Satan, and of course the dog goes, blah, blah. So there was an automatic payoff every time, and then I put out the bucket, and then just go to the next town, and so I was a street performer for like a long, long time, like 2.5 years.
Okay.
That's amazing.
And that kind of evolved into eventually got rid of the preacher guy, and I was just doing sketches and stuff, and so that was my start. So by the time I got on a real stage, it was like, what? Ready-made crowd? Really?
Yeah. And how old were you then? Like,
I was about 24.
Yeah, so, wow. So you'd been actually performing in a style, in a way, for a couple of years before you got anywhere near
the stage.
And it wasn't stand-up. It was like sketching
No, but
character
it was.
Stuff.
But so I'd go into coffee houses. I went into one in Tempe, Arizona, and everything was, the colleges were shutting down for Christmas. And I just thought, well, I got to get out of this college racket. This is like a big inside joke, you know.
Yeah.
The people at the colleges get it, but a crowd at a club, you know. Carlin was huge. Steve Martin had taken off. And so it was like, to be a comedian at that point was like perfect. It was like, you know, wow, comedy is like huge now. You know, it really had skyrocketed. So there were some clubs in New York and L.A. That was about it. You know, the Comedy Store and the Improv in New York. And so that's where I ended up. And but I just started taking stuff from the stand-up, from the street performing and just adopting it to stage, you know.
Amazing. And how long was it until you ended up on TV with it? Was it Saturday Night Live? Was that...
No. My first time on TV was... I got hired to write on the Letterman show.
Yeah, okay.
From an audition in New York where the guy who started Bud Friedman, he just said, the Letterman people... He's starting a morning show. The Letterman people are coming in. They're looking for writers. Get your 6-8 minutes of your A material. You know, I don't have much faith in you, but I'm putting you on the showcase. And so... we were working it out during the week, and this and like Seinfeld, Larry David, Carol Leifer, Larry Miller, they were all in the showcase. And so we'd all go up. We went up for 2 or 3 nights, and we ran our 8 minutes, and it was just like everybody's good. If I'm as good as these guys, fine. I'm not going to be better than them, but like we're all good. And the stand-up isn't going to work. And I went out, and I used to do this crazed Vietnam vet some nights who would knock on the side door at the Improv and just with a pizza and a army jacket. And he was just a stressed out vet, Vietnam vet. And I was supposed to do like my 20 minute set, but I would spend the whole 20 minutes trying to make someone pay for this pizza. And just sitting, you know, so I didn't even, I just went right across the stage and right into the audience. And I just said, "That you. Did you order this pizza? You look like a guy. Did you serve in Vietnam? No. So you, oh, daddy got you out. Yeah. So anybody who dodged Vietnam would dodge paying for a pizza. And eventually, someone would just, all right, fine, we'll pay for your pizza. I did it, but I knew Letterman was in the audience, and I just worked it out so that I ended up basically making him pay for the pizza. And Meryl Marco was the
That's pretty ballsy to make David Letterman pay for the pizza.
That's a choice. And he did. Yeah, somebody at the table paid for it.
Huge though. That's I'm going straight to you. Yeah. I worked my way up to it.
Yeah, right. I was working my way up to it. Yeah. And there was a guy with a big Lacoste with an alligator on his shirt, and I remember just going, yeah, crocodile on your shirt. I remember crocodiles. They're in the Mekong River. One of them took off my buddy's toe. He gave his toe for freedom. And he got the nerve to knock me, to mock me. And we got back to... So Meryl is right at the end of the table, and she's the head writer. And I literally remember this. I got up to her and I went, "Ma'am, did you order this pizza?" And she went, "Why do you keep calling me ma'am?" And I went, "Did you order this pizza? Because I sit outside my trailer at night with my Marlboros and I'm watching fireflies. Remember fireflies? Yeah. They're innocence. You know what they remind me of now?" And she went, "Something traumatic, I expect." And I went, "That's right, incoming. Incoming." And then she says, and everybody heard her. She said, "Let me ask you a question." She said, "If you're in the Mekong River, why would you get attacked by a saltwater crocodile?" And I went, "What?" And she went, "It'd be a freshwater crocodile, wouldn't it?" I went, "I don't know, man. Maybe it was an invasive species that I didn't have time for because I was worried about a more fucking invasive species in fucking Viet Cong." And it's like, that was just it. Fucking, yeah. And that nailed it. So they hired me as a writer. And this is the morning show. And it was like, "What are we doing?" They had no idea. They had no idea what they were doing. 90 minutes to fill in the morning. They canceled all these game shows. People were angry. They're writing, "Where's the fucking Hawaiian holiday giveaways?" Right. And because we had, like, they started stupid pet tricks, you know, and all kinds of stuff like that. And so we got this kind of college following and kind of hip following for a live morning show. Sure. But within about 4 shows, I said, "Hall, you got to go on and do something." So we didn't care because it was morning and we already figured nobody's watching this. Yeah, right. So I got really used to going on live TV like right away.
Yeah.
You know.
That's an amazing story. Yeah. And so ballsy.
Yeah.
As well. I see you, and you are the person mm-hmm. that I need to impress, yeah. and I'm going to end up at you.
Well, I was just kind of thinking, you know, if I don't get it, I don't get it.
Yeah,
it's
right?
Like, you know, I'll just give it a shot, because everybody else is coming out here, and Larry Miller came out and did his six stages of drinking or something.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're rocking it.
They're ripping it, yeah.
But I think they were watching that going, well, you know, we don't, that's not what we need.
No.
What we need is somebody who's can just come up with crap every damn day.
Just come up with, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you've been doing that. I mean, you've been doing that ever since, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Not come up with crap every day.
Oh, a lot of it was crap.
But how did you end up going from your career in the States, to how'd you end up in Britain, and how did that end up leading to Otis Lee and the music?
I came over here because I was playing a lot of clubs in America, but I had these books out that were really popular called Sniglets that were words that should be in the dictionary that aren't.
Yeah.
And
still available?
Yeah, you can probably still find them. Okay. And they hit, like, they went to, like, number... Never went to number one. The Rand McNally Road Atlas beat me every week. But one of them went to number two. One of them went to number eight. There were about six of them. And over about a 4 or 5 year period, I was writing them. And so the clubs would go, so Rich Hall, inventor of Sniglets. But they never worked on stage.
Right.
I just couldn't make them work on stage.
Right.
They basically were just neologisms, you know.
But you had to read them.
Car perpetuation, the act of running your vacuum cleaner over a piece of string or lint eight times and then picking it up, looking at it, putting it back down, giving the vacuum cleaner one more chance. So it was the kind of stuff that an observational comedian could make a joke out of. But right. I just said, no, that's the word for that. Mm. And so the clubs were just going, Rich Hall, I'm going to say, these people were like, packing in, and they start yelling, Sniglets, and I just couldn't make them work on stage. You know, hey, what do you call it? When it just wasn't...
Yeah, right.
So it was awful. It was like, it was weird, because, you know, I was making a great living, I'm filling clubs, I'm doing stand-up on, you know, Letterman and Tonight Show and stuff, but the clubs themselves were like, well, I said, would you just don't say Sniglets? And they go, well, we got to sell seats. Mm. So just, you know, don't do them. But we're saying that you're the guy who invented Sniglets.
Wow.
And I was in Montreal, and a girl named Marlena Zwickler came up to me.
Yeah.
And her glasses never fit on her face. Always
pushing them up.
She comes up and she goes, what are Sniglets? Because I saw you at this place called Jimbo's. And in Jimbo's, I was trying to work my set out for the gala. But it was like, Sniglets. And I went, oh, screw this, you know. So it was awful. I just basically, it was crap. But then I did my set the next night on the gala, and she was at that. And she went, boy, that was night and day. What are Sniglets? And I went, ah, fuck that. You don't even want to go there. And she says, well, you're either in, you know, there's a thin line between a rut and a groove. And you should come to Edinburgh. And like an idiot, I went, what does that pay? I said, that's not the question you should be asking. No. You should be asking, how can I revive my fucking moribund career? And she said, just put an hour together. And because I'd been to Edinburgh a year before for VH1 to cover it. And I got to Edinburgh, and it was great. And then I started getting work after that, and it just seemed like nobody here gives a shit about Sniglets. And, like, I can... try anything, you know. I don't have this persona that I had in America of, oh, we have certain... I was kind of a prop comic, actually, in America.
All right.
I had a lot of pieces of plexiglass, and I had weird props. And when I got to Britain, I just thought, I'm going to ditch that and just do stand-up. And then seeing people like Bill Bailey and...
Phil Kay, I remember Phil Kay used to host the late in life stuff, and Phil was like just made it all up. Would never repeat himself twice.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it was just a whole different approach to comedy. And there was no two drink minimums. There was no cheese jalapeno poppers at the clubs. You know, I mean, I was just basically sick of the clubs. And there weren't the idea of playing theaters back then was just involved a lot of running for airports and stuff. You know, and I think also people in Britain, they just kind of got it. You know,
yeah,
and
but America had kind of had that. You know, Catch a Rising Star was like this massive comedy club, like a chain comedy club, had become huge, like too big, when it's just not fun anymore. It's just like pumping out, you're on a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
And Great Britain had so, but the reason we came here is because we, the same thing, we arrived and went through Cairn Corn and realized, oh, this is great, because no one cares. First of all, they don't know who we are. Yeah. They don't care. And they're into it for the funny, and it didn't have that kind of, you know, the biggest club was the Comedy Store. It was only one club.
Clubs, there were clubs in America who would pay $200,000 to call themselves the Improv or Catch a Rising Star, so to use that brand and get to put up a sign. And I just thought, what? You're selling the club. Why aren't you selling? If you have a great show every week, people are going to come back.
Yeah.
And there were clubs like that, but they weren't franchise clubs. They were just, you know, just one, you know, there was a place in Raleigh, North Carolina. It was just great because they just got the best people. And the crowd knew it was going to be a good show. And they never tried to, you know, branch out or call themselves anything other than, it was called Charlie Goodnight's. It was a great club, you know.
Catch Rising Star had a TV show, and suddenly that was the name of the thing. And it kind of, TV comedy kind of ruined
I think you're talking about the Improv.
The Improv, is it?
The Improv had Evening at the Improv.
Evening at the Improv, right.
So they had clubs all over. They started out in New York. But that show was a strip show that running every night, putting on three or four comedians 5 nights a week.
Yeah.
So they were putting on comedians who would then show up at the Improv on Melrose Avenue in L.A. and say, can I go on? And go, no, you're not good enough. But I was on the show. Oh. I was on the TV show. Said, you're on the TV show, but you're not good enough to go on that stage in front of 30 people.
Right.
Yeah. So that's when you knew it was just, it was all going to crash. You know,
so, but you said that you'd done Edinburgh, and you thought this is different, and this is something that I really really like. So when did you then move down to London, or
I went back to the States, but I'd come back over and do like a 3 month tour. Marlene put a lot of stuff together. That's when I realized that every town has a theater.
Mm. Yeah,
every town if it's got 6,000 or more people in it has a theater.
Mm, yeah.
And you just go up the road and play it. You can be home in your own bed a lot of the same nights, you know? You're not sitting there with three comedians over the damn weekend going to the mall, you know?
Yeah.
There's an old joke about the lineup for clubs in America is there's the MC, who's generally a local guy, so he's got all the inside references, so he usually does pretty good. The middle act, he really struggles, and then the headliner, and you do 45 minutes, and then they put the check down on the table while you're on stage, so everybody's to pay up while you're still doing your act. And basically what happens is the rest of the week when you're not on stage, the middle act and the MC follow you around at the mall and watch you buy stuff. it's kind of depressing, you know.
It's really depressing.
It is depressing.
Despite the fact it's there, you know, there are tons of comedians in America who are really good, that's what they do. They do 40 clubs a year, and they know what they're doing, and they're perfectly happy with it. And I just really like the whole British approach. I think you're treated with more respect, you know. I never got a review in my life until I got to Edinburgh, and suddenly, what, you're reviewing comedy? Really? You went, yeah, why not? People laughing at you, you just think, yeah, I'm funny. But then every once in a while, you have someone tell you why you are funny or why you're not funny.
Yeah.
And when they tell you why you are funny, you go, nailed it. Sometimes they tell you things about yourself that you had no idea. Or even, you know, basically review just initially describes your overall persona, you know.
Does a bad review affect you?
No, not really. Usually the bad reviews I got were badly written. And they were just, you know, of course. I think there was a magazine in Edinburgh, the local, their version of Time Out, I forget the name of it, but they always seemed to have it in for me. But it was always being, the American comedian is very slick. And that's something I noticed, is that if you're too slick in this country, they don't, you know, you aspire to slickness in America. You aspire to those tight 6-minute talk show spots, you know. And when you come over here, you have to be a bit, they don't quite trust that, you know. They just think you're just phoning it in, you know.
Yeah. Mm. You have to disguise it a bit.
Yeah. And if you make a mistake, it's like, what? Like, I don't know how to get out of this. And people laugh at, they can see that you're struggling, but if you're still confident, you know. I mean, Late in Live was that was the litmus test for whether you belonged in Edinburgh or not, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, your own shows, you're going to do probably a structured show. Late in Live, man, you just had no idea what was going to happen. And they either loved you or they hated you.
Yeah.
You know.
Mike Wilmot always makes fun of me for having a guitar because he's an amazing comedian, but he calls it a cheat stick. He goes, "Do you get your cheat stick with you, Phil? Can I have your cheat stick?" And I keep bringing it up on this podcast because it obviously irritates me, but I bet he doesn't say that to you.
You are Scott.
No, he doesn't say it to me because he's seen me spend hours at the piano, plink, 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 and he sees all the frustration that would go into, because if I'm really rehearsing something and anything happened, what? I haven't eaten in 3 days. I got kids, you know. I haven't eaten today.
Your music's great, okay? So as a musical comedian, and because the podcast is about musical comedy, the thing that stands out, though, and if you can take the compliment, is that the songs are great, though. The songs work as songs. They work melodically. They're nice to listen to. You have the voice that you have, and you play the style that you play.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was thinking like J.J. Cale or, I don't know, like just there's a whole raft of writers. John Prine is like a whole raft.
John Prine is a huge influence. I mean, aspire to the lyrics.
Right.
The way a lot of good country singers, not all country singers, a few country singers. Troubadour, the Americana types, like John Prine and people like that. Loudon Wainwright, if you call them country. Tom Waits.
Yeah. All funny, though. Like,
they can be funny, yeah.
But John Prine, let's talk Dirty in Hawaiian.
Yeah. There are quite a few guys like that who can write a great comedy song. But I've read interviews with these people, and they're all a bit scared of them. They're all worried that the comedy song is they're going to be seen as a comedian
novelty
more than a serious musician, right. And I never really had to worry about that. I just want to write comedy songs, but I want them to be musically worthy, you know.
Yeah.
And my influences are really good songwriters. So in the sense of finding the right turn of phrase, that's all it is, you know.
Yeah.
And finding the right thing to say. And Boothby, I think when I started out, Boothby just gave me something. He says, you got to finish these songs. He says, you're just bailing after the last joke.
Right.
After the last big laugh, you just bail.
Yeah.
Finish it out. People will listen to the last few lines of a song and not, it doesn't have to be a huge payoff on the last word, the last phrase of a song.
Sure.
You've nailed it, you know. And seeing people like Flight of the Conchords and Bill Bailey and people like that, there wasn't anything like that in America. Everybody in America was a guy with a guitar and coming up and doing American Pie.
Yeah, sure.
Doing a sin of American Pie that lasted longer than the actual
American
Pie. And
just doing a parody.
Yeah,
just doing a dumb parody. Yeah.
So, of course, you would. And I think, you know, I think Mike feels a bit like that. He's seen too many hacks come up and just send up.
Sure.
And watching them kill. You know, because they will. They'll kill.
Well, of course, because there's that instant recognition.
Yeah.
That's why we play the quick fire parody game on the show. A, for two reasons. Because it's easy to change the word of a song.
Yeah.
But also because there's something about writing an original comedy song. I mean, those artists that we were talking about, that I actually more moved by an artist like Loudon Wainwright, who I think writes great comedy songs, but some of his serious songs are deeply touching.
And it can go back and forth.
Do you write any? Do you write some serious
stuff?
I have
never written a serious song. I've got a...
Are you sure? Like, you have not one that... Not, like, that you,
I have
you
songs,
written,
I have
you,
comedy that you, songs that are not funny enough to play on stage.
Yeah.
But in the right circumstances... people really like them.
Right.
And they go, why don't you do that on stage? I go, it just never worked.
Doesn't work. It's punchlines.
Yeah. I have a song called Atheist Cowboy, which is I don't want to change it now. I could probably make it funnier, but I really just like the way it goes. I think I did it on Boothby's podcast once. Like, I think I've done it a couple
would
times.
Would you play it here?
I could, but...
Oh. Well, we were going to ask you to play something.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you can play whatever you want.
Oh, okay. I'll figure out something.
Okay.
So Rich, we now have Rich Hall being the stand-up in Edinburgh and going to and from America back to the UK. And where does the music come into it?
I invented Otis on a chat show in Melbourne with a girl named Linda Gibson, who is a comedian who's since passed away. But I always had this idea for Otis, I mean, just as a character, and just to come out and, you know, kill 5 minutes on some late night chat show in front of an audience. It wasn't TV or anything. It was a late night chat show. And I thought, I got to have some ending. So I'm going to sing I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself.
Right.
Which is, it's a Burt Bacharach song.
It's a Burt Bacharach.
And I just thought I'm just going to change one line. And darling, if your new love ever lets you down, call me, his body won't be found. That's the only thing I changed. Like, I did the whole song. Seriously, they had a little combo, and I just changed that one line that was fit the character. And after that, I just thought, well, I don't want to come out and do parody songs. And I thought, what if he's just a failed musician, frustrated musician? And I started teaching myself the piano. And I don't know, I think the true influence was my true influence in even being a comedian more than anyone was Tom Waits.
Right.
And if you look back at Otis and that voice, you'll definitely see the Tom Waits connection.
Yeah.
Really gravelly. I could do that, you know. Mm. And I always kind of thought, man, because he made me want to be a comedian, Tom Waits. I saw him opening for Bonnie Raitt when I was street performing in Arizona. And I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
And his, you know, patter between songs. He was a comedian.
Well, he did that Fernwood Tonight in the classic line, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
Yeah.
Which is like, people know that phrase. Yeah. That's a Tom Waits joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And after, and that was always in the back of my mind, like, could I write something vaguely Waitsian, you know? Mm-hmm. And give it a try.
Yeah.
And that's what Edinburgh was for, you know. Yeah. I was doing my regular stand-up show, and then I'd do something else late at night.
Yeah.
What if, you know, 20, 30 people, just give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, really exhilarating, you know.
It was. We had fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't a big part of it. I was just a little part of it, but we look forward to it every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun to watch.
I was looking forward to it more than my regular show.
I think that's part of what happened to that. There's your excitement about it. What took over the whole thing. It just became funnier and funnier and funnier. So the more you really got into it. So,
yeah. I also became a smoker because of that. Because I decided Otis was going to smoke. I didn't smoke.
All right.
But man, I was starting to look forward to that cigarette every night. Two or three of them during the show.
And now 60 a day.
Now I'm off of them, but I'm on these vapes. But yeah, no, that was horrible. But, you know,
suffering for your art.
Yeah, you suffer for your art.
So, that's fascinating insight into your world, Rich. Thanks for that. But we ask our guests to play a number or play a song.
Sure.
Anything you want. I know ones I want to hear, but we'll just...
I have also seen, though, that you've got a keyboard here. So
join us.
I might jump on that.
Cover my mistakes.
I will gladly attempt to.
Yeah, like, that's why
cover mine.
That's why I play with them, so he makes me sound good.
Yeah, yeah. All right. All right, rolling. I don't know that there's ever going to be a famous British country singer, because Brits don't really have the country music names, you know? No one's going to buy an album from Thurston Piffle-White. There was one Brit had the perfect country and western name. Could have been a huge country star, but fate intervened, and this is called the Ballad of Travis Perkins. Perkins was the son of a builder. Daddy's advice was all too familiar. He said, life is hard, son. Work is tough. Do 95% of the job, that's good enough. Few loose fixtures, missing door. Son, you always got to leave the people wanting more. In other words, son, keep it it sat. But it didn't heed his dad's advice. Said, I want to see my neighbor lights. I can picture myself on a Saturday night at the Grand Old Opry. Well, his daddy rolled his eyes and said, Travis, son, you must have rocks in your head, which if you mix with mortar, makes an excellent exterior cladding. Cause everybody likes Johnny Cash, but not as much as Pebble Dash. Uh-huh. Well, he didn't heed his daddy's words. He just played that old guitar till his fingers hurt. He moved to Nashville, bought himself an old jalopy. Would ride around with his guitar, playing every roadhouse and bar, until the night he finally found himself on the stage at the Grand Old Opry. Mm-hmm. Sounded like this. Was there that night? Can't believe what they witnessed. They said, Travis, on the way you play that guitar, boy, you should be in the builder supply business. Cause everybody likes the Dixie Chicks, but not as much as Aggregate Mix. Everybody likes Kris Kristofferson, but not as much as A Lock Conversion. Ryan and I took the rest of the day off. Give me some of that gritty, gritty organ. Make it nasty. Did not know that could be done.
Right? No, I cannot believe that we're here. No, thanks, Rich.
Rich, thank you so much. It's
thank
been
you
so
for
fun.
Giving us that look into your early life as well. I really enjoyed listening to that.
Goodbye, adios, farewell. You'll be glad to hear that we think that your interview went well. But we have other things to get on with now, so you're gonna have to go. I'm sure our paths will cross again, but whoever really knows? It's been fun, it's been musical, it's been comical at times. But now we have to leave you, so goodbye, goodbye.
Well, man, we're so lucky to be talking to people like Rich Hall on this podcast, Songs in the Key of Laugh, with Phil Nickel and
David Timms.
If you guys, please keep listening. We want to do more of these. We want to keep it going. we're getting to the end of the series. It's been so wonderful and edifying to be talking to these great comedy songwriters, but I hope that you're enjoying it as much as we are.
I think we've learned quite a lot as we've been doing it, Phil, as well. Yeah. Since the first episode up to now, I think we've found a bit of a groove and we're really enjoying it, so please keep listening.
If there's anything you guys want us to talk about or discuss, or you've got any little gems of things that we might not know of, feel free to write to us at songsinthekeyoflaugh@gmail.com and let us know and give us some feedback. If you want to see more or hear more of Rich Hall, he's on tour with the Rich Hall Hoedown Deluxe. Go to the offthecurb.com website for tickets and dates.
Please also keep on sending us in your wonderful comedy song submissions for the Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song competition.
And as always, if you want to support the podcast with me and David, then join us at patreon.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh or coffee.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh.
I'm David Timms.
And I'm Phil Nickel.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.